From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is early in the day yet, but we are raising a glass. Prohibition was repealed today in 1933. The 21st Amendment got the taps flowing again after the 18th Amendment effectively shut down the market for booze. Some effects still linger in Georgia, like dry counties and Sunday alcohol laws. The American Prohibition Museum in Savannah is the only museum of its kind in the country. It highlights the history of this period through the stories of its most colorful characters. And Kayla Black and Travis Spangenberg are here from the American Prohibition Museum in Savannah. Welcome to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Travis, I'm going to start with you. 30-second recap, please, for the person who does not remember high school social studies. When and how did Prohibition happen?
Okay, so if you look back to the 1800s, what you had was this massive kind of alcoholism epidemic. They would have called it like drunkenness. Alcoholism wasn't really a term widely used at the time. People were drinking about three times what they drink today, and that's a low estimate. About 7 gallons of pure alcohol a year, which amounts to about 90 bottles of whiskey a year, and that's taking into account, that statistic includes all the teetotalers as well. So the average drinker was drinking a lot more than that, probably 3 or 4 bottles of whiskey a week, while I've had the same bottle of bourbon on my kitchen counter since July. Mm. So you had this epidemic of people just far too inebriated. And eventually, the women that were the real victims of the epidemic, the ones left husbandless and unable to provide for their family, got fed up and they launched a giant religious social movement to get rid of the thing that was terrorizing their lives and taking their loved ones from them.
And among those women, Carrie Nation, at the American Prohibition Museum, she greets visitors, and you've called yourself a Carrie fanatic. So what about her draws you in?
I love Carrie. I always tell Carrie Nation that, I always tell people that Carrie Nation, you don't have to agree with her, but you can sure admire her style. What I really enjoy about Carrie Nation is that her story goes far beyond someone who just smashed up bars. People can often view Carrie as a bit of a fanatic, a bit of a nut, because she's running into bars, smashing them up with a
hatchet. An axe, right?
Yeah, which was her trademark weapon that she named just about everything she ever created merchandise-wise after it. She had the Hatchet newsletter. She lived in Hatchet Hall in Arkansas. But the deeper story is that she was one of those women affected. The love of her life died when she was 21. She had a 1-year-old daughter. She had to leave him, killed her to do so. She had to leave him because he was so drunk all the time. And then he died 6 months after she left him. And that haunted her all her life. She was deeply kind to women who had also been victims of this. And she didn't hate drunks. She didn't hate alcoholics. She went to prisons and did prison outreach, talked to people who she believed were in that position because of what the drink did to them, not because of a deep failing on their part. She saw people's humanity.
Well, Kayla, that's one of the things that is represented in the museum. Alcoholism ruined Carrie Nation's marriage and so many others and led to the death of her husband, which are still serious problems that exist today, even if we don't drink as much. How does the museum tell that side of the story?
The museum likes to expand past those 13 years of prohibition and detail a lot of the things that came through prohibition, social changes, laws that are still in effect. We actually summarize the entire experience and then add about almost 100 years of history on the end of it about the unintended consequences of prohibition in our theater, where we show a short film at the end. A lot of people don't realize, but federal wiretapping happened for the first time during prohibition. The federal penitentiary system was started because of prohibition. The first women's prison was from prohibition. The war on drugs came from the end of prohibition and the Prohibition Bureau no longer having a real job to do. So the far-reaching tendrils of prohibition go into today. People don't drink as much as they used to. And thankfully so. So it doesn't look like Prohibition will be coming back anytime soon, but we still have the remnants of those 13 years left today.
And it was an important time for organized crime, which we will definitely get to. But I'm really interested in this idea of how women played a role. Of course, flappers hit the scene in the 1920s. They are associated with the speakeasies and moonshine and, you know, shucking off their bustles and corsets, cutting their hair. Women won the right to vote in 1920, and it seems like women were getting power and speaking out, even if they had opposing views on alcohol. Was this like the original year of the woman or decade?
Yeah, you could definitely say that. Women really found their own during Prohibition. They had gone from those corsets, the long dresses, the up to 30 pounds of clothing that they were wearing, even in the summertime. And folks like Christian Dior were coming out with these really short dresses. And Coco Chanel came out with her little black dress, which was supposed to be the go-to garment for the flapper, even though black had always traditionally been looked at as mourning clothing. They were wearing makeup. They were cutting their hair short, something that hairdressers were not okay with doing. Many women ended up going to barbers because they were the only people who would cut their hair. They were wearing their stockings rolled down and actually putting blush and rouge on their knees so that you could really emphasize this saucy kneecap that they were showing for the first time. And women were getting jobs. They were working as cigarette girls and speakeasies. They actually had to put bathrooms in establishments for the first time because men and women were going very scandalously to the bathrooms at the same place. And so they had ladies and men's powder rooms to go into. And it really all coalesced in the speakeasy. It was a place that was already sort of under the cover and not something that was, it was a little taboo to go to a speakeasy. And so women going unaccompanied by a man with a group of their girlfriends was just absolutely revolutionary. And that came from the temperance movement, from these ladies taking things into their own. They didn't have the right to vote at the time. And once they garnered the right to vote, it just sort of blossomed for them throughout that, through the 20s and into the 30s.
I'm speaking with Kayla Black and Travis Spangenberg from the American Prohibition Museum. That's in Savannah. Travis, let's talk about how Prohibition played out here in Georgia. Before the 18th Amendment banned alcohol consumption, that was 1919, Georgia was already on board with temperance. Was that all across the state?
Well, I wouldn't say so. The entire strategy of the Prohibition movement was to work it kind of piecemeal, where they started at the county level. If you could get a state to pass a local option law, which was a law that allowed counties to vote themselves dry, you could then work county by county and get enough where you can eventually get a dry state. Normally, that doesn't work very well in the urban areas. Atlanta, Savannah, certainly didn't go dry before they were made to. So in 1908, they had finally got so much of the state to go dry that the entire state went dry. Savannah was incensed. We have quite the culture today of our drinking habits. We have open carry for alcohol on the streets, but a lot of people, I don't think, realize that it goes way back farther than that. Savannah's always kind of enjoyed a good drink. And in 1908, certain people in Savannah were so angered by it, they threatened to become their own state. They were organizing to become the state of Chatham, which would have been a few of the outlying counties of Chatham County where Savannah is and Savannah itself, because they were so offended by this overreach into their culture. And eventually, I think they realized that it would be a lot simpler to just ignore the law and continue business as usual.
So Savannah's drinking culture, there were a lot of speakeasies, and that's something that we think of from the time. Bars with secret passwords, maybe a disguised doorway in an alley with a special knock opening up into an establishment. What were speakeasies like in Savannah during Prohibition? Kayla, do you want to pick that up?
Well, I'll say that that sort of glamorous idea of a speakeasy with the special knocks and the little passwords and stuff, that was very much the not norm. That would have been, people think of like the Cotton Club in New York City, the Crazy Cat in Washington, D.C. Those sorts of places have become iconic because of how many people went there. But the normal speakeasy was really just a location. It was a place where you could get alcohol. It could be in a basement. It could be the second floor of somebody's house. It could be in the back shop of a store. It wasn't necessarily this glitz and glamoury sort of location. So if you'd ask somebody, where can I go and get a drink, they would just give you an address. You'd go there, you'd knock and go in. By far, the most popular kind of speakeasy, quote unquote, in Savannah were Blind Pigs and Blind Tigers. Those were places where somebody would be advertising essentially a sideshow attraction, a blind pig, say, and you'd pay a nickel to go inside. And once you were inside, you'd realize that there is no blind pig, but there was alcohol. You were paying to see this blind pig, and then in return, you would be getting a free glass of alcohol. Savannah also had a system what they called locker clubs. A locker club was an organization where you paid dues, and the dues you were paying were to become a member of the locker club, not for the free alcohol that they provided at the locker club, but the membership itself. The Savannah Yacht Club actually served as a locker club during the time period. And because Savannah wasn't only upset about the fact that their culture was being threatened, but that they were going to lose several hundred thousand dollars worth of revenue from liquor sales and taxes, they ended up taxing the locker club system and ended up making just as much in taxes from the locker clubs that they had lost in revenue from alcohol.
So not as glamorous, but pretty elaborate and pretty, pretty lucrative.
Still sneaky.
Still sneaky in the end. Well, apparently Georgia never actually ratified the amendment to repeal prohibition. Is that true?
Yeah, I believe that is. There were several states, most of them southern or Midwest, that ignored it. You know, you needed a certain amount of states to ratify it. And once they got to that point, which I believe at the time was 36 states, the other ones that hadn't ratified it just left it on the table, which happened with the 18th Amendment as well, but kind of in the opposite way. The 18th Amendment prohibition, when that was ratified by the 36th, two states outright rejected it. Those were Connecticut and Rhode Island, and Maryland refused to enact any kind of enforcement code in their own laws. They basically said that the feds could come enforce it if they wanted to, and so that happened with the 21st Amendment as well. Luckily, the 21st Amendment allowed for states to regulate their own alcohol laws, so they didn't really need to ratify it to stay dry.
Well, during that time, if you turn on the radio, during Prohibition, you might have heard the voice of evangelical preacher Billy Sunday. Here's just a sample.
America needs a tidal wave of the old-time religion. America needs to be taken down to God's bathhouse and the hose turned on her. And the time isn't far distant when the wheels of God's judgment are going to go sweeping through this old God-hating world.
This old God-hating world, we get some fire and brimstone there from the preacher Billy Sunday. And we're talking today about Prohibition, the end of Prohibition, the repeal on December the 5th of 1933, long time ago. We're going to continue our conversation with Kayla Black and Travis Spangenberg from the American Prohibition Museum in Savannah. So stay with us. We'll be back with more on Second Thought. I just have to ask you guys before we go, do you have a favorite cocktail for this day? Travis? Kayla?
Let's go with the French 75.
I enjoy the Brown Derby.
Well, okay. We're going to pick up our conversation in just a minute. This is On Second Thought from Georgia Public Broadcasting. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we're back with Kayla Black and Travis Spangenberg from the American Prohibition Museum in Savannah discussing the repeal of Prohibition 85 years ago today. Well, Travis, we just heard from a Baptist preacher, and even today, Georgia does have a lot of Baptists and a prevailing branch of Southern Baptists that does not allow members to drink alcohol. We heard that represented by those speaking out again recently against the brunch bill, the amendment that just passed to sell alcohol earlier on Sundays. Is the temperance movement alive in Georgia today?
I don't think so. Certainly not in the same way that it was at the time. It's always going to be people's personal choice and their religious choice to imbibe or not imbibe. Generally, what you see with prohibition laws and those relics of prohibition, things like blue laws, is that they don't get more restrictive these days. They're kind of falling apart. You don't see a lot of counties voting to go dry in the 21st century. You see, you know, in this case, an hour and a half added to Sunday sales. You see Sunday sales being allowed altogether and things like that across the country. So the sentiment is there. People are always going to believe that alcohol is something that can be a societal kind of drain. But I don't think that the temperance movement will reignite and take it from us again.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to. It's not considered a moral failing, but more biological and physical now, I think. But let's get back to some of these figures that are you talk about and represent at the museum. A prominent Savannah figure during Prohibition was Wolf Silver. He had a whiskey bootlegging strain. He transported liquor for Al Capone. He was also named Bo Peep. Who was he and how did he get that nickname?
Okay, so Wolf is one of my favorites. He was a rum runner here in Savannah. He had connections up to Chicago with Bugs Moran, and he was London-born, but he moved to Savannah when he was very young. And at some point, Bugs decided that he'd had enough of Wolf, and he was set up to be arrested, pulled in his entire crew, and he was the only member of his crew to escape that arrest. And so people started to say, oh, Bo Peep, he lost all his sheep because of his name Wolf. And the nickname kind of stuck. He ended up going to prison in the Savannah 4 raid. And he, when he got out, people were still calling him Bo Peep. So he opened up Bo Peep's Billiards Room on Congress Street, same street that the museum kind of borders and our speakeasy enters through. And a little ways down the road, though. And he served apparently the best roast beef sandwich in Savannah out of there and also alcohol, which Christ Church, his neighbor, was not a huge fan of. He did, however, open up a food, like a soup kitchen out of Christ Church to kind of be a good neighbor.
Right. And it was the distribution center for alcohol, all far reach. Kayla, another guy in Al Capone's employ in Savannah, Moose Helmy. He helped the legendary gangster fix up his rum runner cars out of his garage. So how did common people get involved and mixed up in this rum running gig?
Well, as far as Moose is concerned, it was sort of happenstance. In fact, it was just a situation in which one of Al Capone's vehicles in Savannah had gotten a little banged up, and they pulled into Moose's garage, which is off of Wright Square, downtown Savannah, and said, hey, I need you to fix this up, and once the car's fixed, take it over to the DeSoto Hotel and to the top penthouse floor, and we'll pay you and thanks a whole bunch. So he kind of became a little bit suspicious, but he fixed the car, took it, went up to that penthouse in the DeSoto, and it turns out that he had been working for Al Capone fixing this car. Al was so pleased with the work that he had done that he put Moose into his employ. And so what Moose used to do is make what he called shoe salesman cars, which essentially were cars that had tons of hidden compartments where you could put alcohol, your weaponry. And then he also helped Al with the very common practice that police had by trying to disable these rum runner cars is they would shoot out the radiator because that would almost immediately disable the vehicle. So what Moose and his guys would do is they would set up stations along the way where they could do these swap outs of radiators, and they became very good at it, so much so that they could just essentially pull one radiator out, pop the other one in, like a NASCAR pit stop, and the rum runners could keep going on their way. He became very, very essential to Al Capone here in Savannah. Years later, he would get his captain's license and become a boater. And his daughter, Captain Judy Helmy, actually still runs the family business today off of Wilmington Island in Savannah.
So we think of these big folks in New York and Chicago in the typical gangster image, but there were a load of people who were bootleggers. Savannah had its own history and collective with low country residents. Do we have any idea how much moonshine was produced and transported on Georgia roadways?
No. It was a massive amount. In fact, they called Savannah the spigot of the South. We were just perfectly placed among the marshes and the jetties of the Atlantic coast to be just secretive enough where the federal boats could not navigate those small waterways, but the locals knew well enough where they could get a boat, where they could dock, where they could sneak in. You can see all over the Lowcountry remnants of this. There's a Beer Can Island where there are stills located. Obviously, it gets its name from the large number of beer cans located on it. If you go to Skidaway Island State Park, which is part of the National Parks or the State Park Service, there are a few stills that you can see today. And if you walk away from those stills, you can see exactly where those moonshiners would have pulled their boats up onto the shores of the park and walked in and cooked their moonshine, loaded up, and went. There were speakeasies in the marshes of Wilmington Island, one specifically called Greens, where depending on the color of the buoys that they put up meant that there was alcohol at the bottom of the buoy or not, so you could pull up the bottle and or the jug. It's hard to tell how much was carried on Georgia roads, but so much so that the moonshine runners who actually did transport that liquor became pretty competitive with one another and started NASCAR up in northern Georgia because of it.
This is just a fascinating history and so much laid out there. We get Moose, Bo Peep, Saucy Kneecaps, a fascinating job and a fascinating conversation. Kayla Black and Travis Spongenberg from the American Prohibition Museum in Savannah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's a museum that CNN Travel calls the best bar in Savannah. Imagine that for a museum. So if you're there, you can celebrate the repeal of Prohibition with Kayla and Travis at the museum starting at 6 o'clock. And more details can be found on our website, gpb.org. Chuck Reese of the Bitter Southerner fame is mixing up something new, a podcast with GPB. It launches later this month, but in keeping with our repeal of prohibition theme, here is a sneak peek of Chuck speaking with cocktail historian and mixologist Tiffany Barrier. They met when Tiffany was mixing drinks at Twisted Soul and Cookhouse Pours in Atlanta to chat about her years on the job and representation in the industry.
When I got in this industry over 10 years ago, I wasn't really categorized as a woman of color. I was categorized as a woman. So gender was very important then because this is a white male dominated industry. Being a woman was first things first. Like, whoa, that's a woman doing this? That was the shakeup part. It wasn't difficult. It was just not respected. I was looked at as like a cocktail waitress or maybe she doesn't know everything. And then within the past 10 years, it was looked at as a woman of color.
Have you seen the field change and get more diverse, like more different kinds of people coming into it?
I have, actually. What's been really cool is that this has been a profession. This is all, you know, I used to be a bunch of cooks, now there's a lot of chefs. Used to be a couple of, you know, college kids just doing this to make some change before they got a real job, and now it's a real job. With that being said, some people of color have realized that, you know what, I can actually be in a hospitality or a restaurant job and it be considered an actual career. And whereas I've seen years ago, one of my uncles said it years ago, I can't believe you're in hospitality. We've been doing this our whole lives. Why would you choose to keep serving the people? And I'm like, because the people got to eat and they got to drink. I like people. I like food. I like Bev. it matches. Oh, you get really good money off of this too. It's a gratitude. The bittersweet, as we say, the bittersweet of African-American history in the South is we were the help. We were the slaves. We did all the cooking and the cleaning, the raising and the cocktails. And so hearing how much food came out of it, that's how many cocktails came out of it. So knowing that African-Americans had such an impact to the whiskey world, you know, growing all the wheat and the corn and the rye, along with all the garnishes that went along with it, that to me is the most impactful part of cocktail history. We not only did we know how to make the cocktail, we actually knew how to actually make the spirits, which was bourbon, brandies, syrups. We actually knew how to cook, a liquid cook.
It was the night, not only when I met you, but it was when I met Dave Wondrich, and he told me, you know, I've got this story I can't write for anyone else about the history of African-American bartenders in the South in the 19th century. And I was like, please write that for me. And I think it was, you know, maybe a year later when we ran the thing. And, you know, since then I've learned so much more about that history. You know, and one person I've learned about even more recently is Tom Bullock, who I believe was the first African-American bartender to write and publish his own bar guide.
Yes, sir. It's still a question if he wrote it. He wasn't literate. His slave owner, possibly, even though he was slightly freed. This is around the time of emancipation. But even though emancipation happened, a lot of slaves didn't leave home.
Yeah.
Had nowhere to go. It's like a prisoner being in prison forever and then being like, okay, you can go, but he can't get a job because he's a prisoner. Speaking of that, I'm about to make that cocktail right now. It's been ordered.
Which cocktail are you going to make?
So this is one of my favorite cocktails. From Sir Tom Bullock himself. That busy is he. This is the late 1800s, and you're calling a cocktail the busy is he? I'm like, yes. This guy is amazing. He is the number one in-house server of the house. He can cook, he can clean, and he can definitely make cocktails. And only a few things are really available. You know, here we are in the South, and you have your lemons, your limes, your oranges. Apples are a little different, but no one's making syrups at this time, you know. But you see a pineapple every damn where. Also, you got things being shipped in from the Caribbean. You're getting a lot of island flavors. Bitters are coming in. Absinthe coming in from France. Brandy is everywhere. Rye is plentiful. So this is one of my favorite cocktails. This is a little bit of pineapple gomme, which is a sweeter side of the pineapple, with some sherry, a little bit of rye and lemon juice.
My mouth is watering.
It's a busy Izzy. I love making the drink only because it has all the flavors and the buzz that you really, really want. Y'all, the busy
Izzy.
Just imagine drinking these drinks at this time in life. I mean, seriously.
Oh my God. Mr. Bullock, his book was called The Ideal Bartender.
Yes, he was called The Ideal Bartender.
This drink makes me want to agree with that title. All right. One last thing. One of the classic, widely known Southern cocktails is the Sazerac.
Yes.
What do we know about the origin of the Sazerac and who had input in coming up with it? I know it's a really twisted story.
It's a twisted story. Here's my whiff on it. Dr. Peychaud, a brother, a man of color.
Antoine Amédée Peychaud.
Dr. Peychaud. You came to this guy. This guy was like, he was like the Dr. Seuss of booze, they say. He was indeed a pharmacist, a.k.a. all bartenders were pharmacists at this time. And, you know, here he is serving you what he has. He's in New Orleans. He's got this cherry bitters. He's got absinthe. He's got sugar. He's got brandy or cognac or bourbon. The story blends. Again, we're drinking. And everyone would come to this man for a shot of it. He would serve it in the jigger. I don't think they had two-in-ones back then.
Yeah.
I think they kind of just had like a cup, the coupe, and a 1 ounce. And he'd make this cocktail in the coupe, and you'd come in and do a shot with this guy, and you'd walk out the door. It got you together. It was the, I mean, I wasn't there. I think I wanted to be. But it just got you together. It just, it was a drink of all components that shared variety and flavor and balance. And a brother was doing it, and he was free. He was in his own little pharmacy. Swing door, hear the bell. Come in there, look at all the elixirs and tonics you're gonna get, but then before we go, it's like, let me get that quick shot of good so I can continue. Sazerac was the very first cocktail in New Orleans. New Orleans at this time was a pretty free city. We had a lot going on, but to be brown, or to be Latin, or to be French, or to be Anglo was not a problem.
Right.
And you came to the quarters, you came to the four corners, obviously, to share your trade, cross boundaries, high five, get drunk, buy a pretty woman, sell yourself, whatever you did, and it was A-okay. Oh, and there was jazz music the whole time, so.
Really amazing jazz.
Wonka, 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 na, 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 na. And you're bringing in Caribbean flavors, you're bringing in South America, you're coming off the cusp of the East Coast. It was the quarters. Dr. Peychaud showed it all in one drink.
Chuck Reese there speaking with mixologist Tiffany Barrier. A little preview sip of the soon-to-be-released Bitter Southerner podcast from GPB. Coming up, we'll hear about the restoration of Atlanta's Cyclorama. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Tomorrow, we're going to get gift book suggestions with booksellers from across the state. So if you're looking for someone or something for the history or fiction or biography buff in your life, or maybe you just want to hear about some thoughts on best books of the year from people who sell them by hand, you can join us. And we welcome your suggestions. You can leave us a voicemail at 404-500-9457 or find us on Twitter and Facebook. And be sure to join us at 9 tomorrow for more. Atlanta's Cyclorama is back. The 18,000 square foot spectacle was looking faded and anachronistic by 2011 when the city considered scrapping it. Instead, the 360-degree image of the Battle of Atlanta is being restored and will open at the Atlanta History Center in February of next year. Jack Hitt is co-host of the Uncivil podcast, and that won a Peabody Award for telling historically accurate stories about the Civil War. His article, The Salvation of Atlanta, similarly revises common beliefs about the Cyclorama, and it is in the December issue of Smithsonian Magazine, and he's on the line with us now. Jack Hitt, hello.
Hi, Virginia. How
well,
you doing?
I am really glad to speak with you because this was a fascinating story. I've been hearing about the Cyclorama for a long time. People I know of a certain age said that they went on school trips every year to the Cyclorama, and you went as a kid. What do you remember?
I did. My mother and her best friend and that friend's daughter, we all got in a car one day and went to Atlanta to for a weekend trip or something. And we did Stone Mountain. It was a kind of neo-Confederate tour, don't you? So I grew up in Charleston, South Carolina. So, Atlanta's, that's a distant city for when you're a little kid. But when we got there, the big entertainments were the giant carving on the side of Stone Mountain and of course, the Cyclorama.
So you went big.
We did. It was all about big stuff.
Well, what exactly is a Cyclorama?
So, it's an old medium. I mean, think about like cassette tapes or 8-track or your Kodak Brownie camera. We live in an era of discarded, old, dead media. And this is the great grandfather of dead media. So in the 1880s, this is like 20 years before movies. So we're all in this sort of like inventive moment of coming up with media that would allow us to see something that felt three-dimensional. You remember your great-grandparents, like stereoscopes and all that?
Mm-hmm.
So this was a giant sort of epic version of that. You would go into this room and walk up onto a platform, and suspended all the way around you 360 degrees would be this 2.5-story painting that was 1.5 football fields in diameter, right, or circumference. And it would be bowed out in a funny way, and the lighting would hit only the painting so that when you stood there, it was as if you were standing on a top of a hill, seeing the entire battlefield around you, like some kind of commanding general. And understand also that at this time, like, there was no aerial photography. There was, you know, a little bit of etchings in Harper's Magazine. Matthew Brady's photographs were around. But, like, the big picture was something that you had to conjure in your imagination.
So this just blew people's minds, right? It's like IMAX, I guess.
Right. And the way the painting is set up, you know, the way it's painted and bowed, it gave this three-dimensional sort of, like, you know, illusion to your eye and brain. So it really felt like you were standing in a three-dimensional space. So it's kind of freaky, too.
Yeah. When you write about it, as when it opened in Minneapolis, this was the Battle of Atlanta Cyclorama, opened in Minneapolis, Northern audience, of course, 1886. So, right. You know, a couple decades after the war ended. And it was praised by even General Sherman, he was quoted in the newspapers, for giving a sense of being in battle and depicting a very specific moment of the battle. So could we get a quick history refresher on the Battle of Atlanta?
So the Battle of Atlanta is ultimately a Confederate loss, but that was not certain until the very end. So at the time, Atlanta was, you know, of course, you know, the juncture of these railroad lines. It was this crucial city, as it still is in the life of the regional South, right? And so at this precise moment in July, the Northerners had set up this artillery line, and the Southerners at one point had broken through and were rushing in to take on the seemingly scattered, you know, behind the lines, Northern fighters. And then from far away, Blackjack Logan, General Logan, comes swooping down and pushes the Southerners back behind that artillery line. And that all happened in sort of one late afternoon moment, they say around 4:45 p.m. And when that pushback happened, essentially that kind of concludes Atlanta's fall. And then Sherman marches to the sea after that. Lincoln wins re-election. This is summer of 1864, wins re-election that fall, and the war comes to its end.
So a super really tense moment.
This is a very tense moment. This is, you know, fourth and 15 to go. And when the ball is snapped, no one quite knows what's going to happen. And that's kind of captured all in this painting that you're standing in.
It's in Minneapolis. And Paul Atkinson, 1891, you call him, I think, a sort of low-grade P.T. Barnum, buys it and brings it to Atlanta, the scene of the Battle of Atlanta. Eventually, it comes down to the South first. So tell us about how it changed once it got down South.
So it starts in Minneapolis. It goes to another northern city. And remember, you know, northern audiences had money, mm-hmm. right? Because this is right after the war. This is in the Reconstruction era for the South. So the South is still broke. So all of these paintings were basically made for the northern audiences. But eventually they started to work their way down. You would roll up these things and travel down to the next city and set them up in some giant auditorium and charge a small admissions fee. And so when as it got sold, Atkinson, this kind of like poor man's kind of P.T. Barnum, brought this thing to Chattanooga. And when he hung it up, you know, he realized that, you know, there were certain aspects of this that just didn't fit into the story that the South was telling itself about the Civil War in the 1880s. Specifically, in this battle, there's a bunch of Confederates that have been taken prisoner. And you see this Yankee gentleman with a Confederate flag in his hand, right? The mark of surrender. And at this point, remember, the war, the way this everyone North and South is talking about the war is as kind of noble military campaigns. This is when we get like the elevation of Lee as a great general and Stonewall Jackson. Mm-hmm. That's the conversation. So this all has to be about brave military procedure, right? And maneuvering and flanking maneuvers. And so having a bunch of Confederates being taken prisoner, losing, that didn't fit in. So Atkinson had all of those soldiers repainted as Northern soldiers fleeing battle.
So they just like wiped out the canvas and repainted.
Right. Just painted blue over the gray. Just went directly into, got a pure, specific oil-based revisionist history. It's kind of marvelous, actually. And so now these people who are being marched off one way now look like they're running away. And so that shifted the battle just enough so that something that was a Union victory and sold that way in the North, by the time it gets down to Chattanooga and ultimately to Atlanta, right, in Bryant Park, it's declared the Great Southern Victory.
Wow.
Literally headlines in the paper saying, come see the Southern Victory, the Battle of Atlanta. Maybe it's the first instance of what we might call fake news.
Yeah, that is, it was a pretty decisive battle, yet recast. We're talking with Jack Hitt. He's a frequent contributor to This American Life, and he wrote about the kind of twisted history and current restoration of the Atlanta Cyclorama for the December issue of the Smithsonian Magazine. So this vast painting's enjoyed by Yankees, praised by vets for its accuracy, then moves down south to be sold to Southerners, getting a little bit of a touch-up. But it arrived in the South at a really critical time, just about a generation after the Civil War, when the war was being recast as the Lost Cause. So what is behind that narrative?
Well, so, you know, the Lost Cause goes through a number of different cycles and revisions, right? So I was talking about the elevation of the generals as these kind of great military and smart strategic thinkers. And most kids grew up, you know, memorizing battles and maneuvers and flanking and all this kind of stuff. That kind of is the late 19th century version of the Lost Cause. After sort of Woodrow Wilson and, the rise of the Klan, there was a kind of like more user-friendly kind of racism that took hold in the South. And that's the, you know, Aunt Jemima and Uncle Ben kind of version of the Lost Cause. It wasn't so bad. Slavery wasn't so bad. And here are these, you know, sort of retainer figures right on the box of your items there at the grocery store. And that kind of culminates in the Gone with the Wind story, the movie, which the production designer for that movie, which, you know, is really just Southern lifestyle. There are no battles, by the way, in the entire Gone with the Wind. It's not about the war. The war is way in the background. What's up front in that movie is the lifestyle of being a noble Southern aristocrat on the plantation. And so that more user-friendly sort of lifestyle of the South became really embodied in the new Confederate flag. So remember, the Confederate flag that Confederates fought under is not the one we all see, the St. Andrew's Cross.
Right, the cross.
That became more stylized in the 20th century as the emblem. And so what you see in the painting is that the man who was the production designer for Gone with the Wind, Wilbur Kurtz, he's the guy who took over restoring the cyclorama in Atlanta in the 30s, right at the time that he is designing the look and feel of Gone with the Wind. And it's he who puts in dozens of, you know, the Confederate flag that we all now recognize as the Confederate flag. He puts in a sound system and has Dixie playing. It becomes this much more sort of like kind of jokey Dukes of Hazzard kind of version of the Battle of Atlanta.
Well, this is also at a time when many Confederate monuments were constructed in the early 20th century around the country, around the South. And you know, by the time after the Voting Rights Act, certainly any attempts to it becomes terribly outdated. And I'm wondering if have been any attempts to sort of recontextualize the cyclorama, as some argue, is a means to keep Confederate monuments intact, to tell the story, put them in context, but keep them up.
Right. Well, you know, there's a very famous moment after the Civil Rights Act. So we're talking 1964, 65 era, right? And at that point, the cyclorama has been hanging in the zoo there in Atlanta for almost 100 years. It's tattered and old. It's not bowed anymore. He just kind of went in there and looked at it, you know, kind of this sad, broken down sort of like circus attraction. Still advertised as this great Southern victory. And then, lo and behold, Atlanta elects Maynard Jackson, mayor. And there's a kind of emperor's new clothes moment when the folks in the city government kind of wanted to junk the whole thing, just put it in storage, let it rot, and then maybe toss it away decades later. And Maynard Jackson went and looked at the painting and said, this is a northern victory.
Hmm.
This is a victory that was instrumental in the emancipation of my people. And I think we should keep it and tell that story. And so then there was a new sound system put in. This one had James Earl Jones as the narrator. And let me just assure you that the story was somehow very, very different than what it had been under Wilbur Kurtz. And so the story of the cyclorama became a little closer to what actually it depicted, right? And then in a way you come up to now. It was almost being junked a couple of years ago again, for very similar reasons. It's tattered. At one point when they hung it in the zoo rotunda there, it didn't fit, so they just razored out about 6 feet the image and just stuck it together like, whatever, you know. And understand that one part of the visual effect was that at the bottom of the canvas, you would often have like dirt and sort of like campfires and like diorama stuff, like real world three-dimensional stuff that would add to the visual effect. And those were all life size. There was even like when Gone with the Wind premiered, right? And Rhett Butler came and saw the whole thing. Clark Gable famously said, it's fantastic, this cyclorama. The only thing I don't like about it is that I'm not in it. So Kurtz actually put a dummy of Clark Gable on the ground. And that will still be there, by the way, when you go see it today. So, what I'm going to say is that the bottom of the canvas had kind of rotted out. So it was really in terrible condition. And that's where it all lay until about, 2 years ago.
So that's when Sheffield Hale of the Atlanta History Center, working with the real estate mogul Lloyd Whitaker, started raising money to restore it. $25 million, huge restoration project going to be opening up in February here in Atlanta. And I'm going to let readers of Smithsonian Magazine look at some of the pictures, terrific photographs accompanying it, and also more of the story. It goes much deeper, but I'm so glad we touched on some of it. But I just want to ask you, with a half a minute left, basically, you are the host with Chenjerai Kumanyika of the Peabody Award-winning Uncivil podcast, which proposes to ransack American history, demystifying our understanding of the Civil War. So quickly, how does the cyclorama fit in?
Well, so much of the Civil War got told in the sort of healing years of the 1880s and 90s, when the country was obsessed with reforging the Union, right? Putting both sides back together, that there was this very narrow kind of military story told about the Civil War. It's not that that's not true. That's very true. But there's a whole other war that was happening around that military war. And that war had to do with things like this, this revisionist sort of painting making its way around the country. There were many insurrections and there were breakaway states in the South, broke away from the Confederacy, right? But you don't hear these stories. There were copperheads and Southern sympathizers in the North. New York City tried to break away from the Union at one point. But these stories that complicate the simple healing narrative just really don't get told in our history books. And so Chenjerai and I decided, why don't we tell those stories?
Well, and you tell them well. And Jack Hitt, this one is just a terrific story, terrific read. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Jack Hitt, he's co-host of Uncivil. He's a This American Life contributor. And his article, The Salvation of Atlanta, is about the true history of the cyclorama, which reopens at the Atlanta History Center in February of 2019. His article is in the December issue of Smithsonian Magazine, really worth reading and looking at. The photographs are by Joshua Rashad McFadden. That's all we have time for today. Thanks so much for joining us, spending a little time with On Second Thought. We'll be back again tomorrow.